System on RadioArea.com.
Croeso I Cymru. Welcome to Wales. Welcome to the Welsh Forum. Welcome to Cardiff. Now, some of you might not know this, but in 1938, September the 30th, the Lord Mayor and Council of Cardiff raised the swastika flag on the town hall. There's a picture to see. Happy days, eh? Happy days. Yes, Lord Mayor O. Cuthbert Parnell raised the swastika on the town hall as a symbol of peace, as a symbol of support for the Munich Agreement. And that's not very long ago in the greater scheme of things. Francis Fukuyama spoke of the end of history. He spoke of the advance, the rule of universal liberalism. The ending of history. A universal peace would descend on the world. Everyone would go to sleep. There'd be no more real politics. People would become slaves and fall asleep and become very lazy and just get involved with leisure and pleasure and hedonism and ignore everything else. Now, whether he really believed that or not, or whether he was just playing to the gallery, playing to his puppet masters, we don't know. But in any case, liberalism has been revealed now as just another ideology. Liberalism is just an ideology that's had its day. Liberalism has failed. The new war in the world is between identity and globalization. Globalization, globalism, so loved up by the Jews, the globalists, they thought they had won. But now they are realizing that all they've done is for about 70 years they've kept people's identity down, like a pressure. They put their hand on the pressure valve, and the pressure's been building all these years. And it's now back with a vengeance. Identity is rearing its head again. Some years nothing happens. You know, you can go by 10 years nothing happens, and then one day, one week, and 10 years happens. And in Turkey, over the last week, we've seen a lot of changes there. In Turkey, there is something called the deep state. The deep state is the secret government, the shadow government, the secret conspiracy that really rules Turkey, like in so many other countries. And this deep state is controlled by the Donme sect. The Donme sect were Jews who became Muslims to have an easier life in Turkey. Same with other Muslim countries. The Donme sect, the Gulen sect, these are Jewish converts to Islam, Maranos of the Islamic world, if you will. Liberal Muslims who believe in secularism, egalitarianism, as long as they're on top and having all the money and the power, and good relations with Israel and America. You know the sort of people. And they and their Freemason dupes, they're the ones who really control Turkey. Or they used to. They used to. And any time a government gets elected in Turkey they don't like, there's an American-backed coup, and the government's taken over, and something to the America's liking, to Israel's liking, is put back into power. Same with Egypt recently, with the Tahrir Square people's revolution, which was just another military coup. The New World Order tells these secret governments what to do and how to do it. It's the same in us all Muslim states. They're all ruled, just like the West, by a liberal elite, a secret liberal elite. However, a few days ago, there was a coup in Turkey. The same people had the coup, but it didn't go according to plan. This time, the coup failed. And this is thanks to the internet and to mobile phones and to a resurgent sense of identity. The normal working class Turks were mobilized. They rose up, many were killed, but they foiled the coup. A thing I've unheard of before. Likewise, in the UK, the white working class rose up and voted for Brexit. And we got a victory. And a good thing too. And ever since, the liberal elite in Britain has been whinging and gnashing their teeth and whining and complaining. Now Erdogan in Turkey, President Erdogan, is now having a purge. He's culling the liberal elite. He's sacking the liberal elite. He's putting them in prison. He's threatening to execute them. Some commentators are even calling this purge in Turkey a new Jewish pogrom. And all liberal commentators are worried. Today in Turkey, tomorrow other countries, tomorrow other nations. Liberalism has failed, and it's about to be swept away out of existence, and good riddance. Swept away by the forces of truth and reality, aided by the internet. Now, everywhere in the world, we whites are under attack. Whites are being killed everywhere. And excuses are being made by our liberal elites. Oh, this terrorist, he did it because he was mentally ill. His girlfriend left him. He was bored. The weather was hot. You know, he felt like he had to go and kill some policeman or something. Throw a bottle to a policeman. It's not washing. It's not washing. People are beginning to wake up. Now, whether the whites are killed by Muslims, whether they're killed by black power fanatics, black lives power fanatics, it does not matter. The end is the same. The subconscious underlying urge is the same. Kill the whites. Even that Muslim who carried out the Orlando gay club attack, he was running around gunning down gays left, right and centre. And he found some black gays in the toilets. He said, "No, I'm not. I'll leave you. I'll let you live. You blacks have suffered enough. I want the whites." So that's what's happening. That he wanted to kill whites. And it doesn't matter whether you're Spanish, whether you're British, whether you're American, whether you're German, whether you're in London, Paris, Madrid, or Orlando, or Munich. All that matters is that you are white. Because that's all that matters to the enemy. Our people need to realize they are under attack. Not just through destruction of their culture and religion tradition, but under attack physically. Their lives are under threat. Rivers of blood, my friends, rivers of blood. Like the Roman, I seem to see the Tiber foaming with much blood. Not just the Tiber, but the Thames and the Taff, the Danube, the Seine, the Rhine. How do rivers begin? They begin with a spring, a rivulet, a brook, a stream, and they get bigger. Our people, white people, are being raped, being mugged, being stabbed, being shot, being bombed everywhere. We're being slaughtered. Lambs to the slaughter. And it's going to get a lot worse. This is the beginning. This is how it begins, the race war. And our people need to wake up and be warned. To be forewarned is to be forearmed. Our people need to realize they are white. They are white. They need to realize they are being attacked because they are white. They need to realize there is nothing wrong with being white. Nothing wrong with standing up for themselves as whites. Nothing wrong and everything right with shouting to the world, "White lives matter." We're tired. Tired of being victims, tired of being slaves. It's time we stood up and threw off our chains. It's time we remembered who we are. It's time we took back control. We, the white race, are the bringers of beauty. And the world is a beautiful place. And it's time we took it back. Yeah. So, our next speaker is a man you all know well, a man you all respect. He's here to talk about current events. Current events are moving very fast today, very fast indeed. So please put your hands together and give a very, very warm welcome to Richard Edmonds.
Thank you very much for the invitation to speak here in Cardiff. I apologise for the fact that we arrived a bit late, but our train just arrived at Cardiff Central a few minutes ago. I join with Jez in appreciating the setting up of this forum here, thanks, in Cardiff. This Cardiff meeting joins all the others that have been set up. Jez and others have set up these forum meetings in Edinburgh, in Bradford, in London and elsewhere. And it is a great pleasure to join in with you and to support this meeting, which is dedicated, an all-nationalist meeting, and a meeting dedicated to truth in history, which we all believe in truth in history. Jez gave us a little touch of truth in history. I did not know, I have just come to Cardiff to find out that on that day in September 1938, which my parents got married just before the Second World War, I can assure you that my parents didn't want a Second World War. And when Chamberlain came back in September 38 with that bit of paper saying, peace in our time, there was cheers right across Britain. But I didn't know that from Cardiff Town Hall, they flew the swastika. I didn't know they flew the Hakenkreuz from Cardiff. That just shows how welcoming people were and how when 12 months later, the Prime Minister went on the radio September the 3rd and announced that from 11 o'clock this morning, Britain's at war with Germany. The heart sunk right across Britain, including my mother's. I was brought up as a kid listening to all this. She didn't want to see her brand new husband march off and never come back again. So, friends, our people, our nation is at a turning point in our history. The country, our country, could go one way or the other. The British people, together with the whole white race, are facing an existential crisis. There has been so much immigration into this country that now one quarter of the births born across the whole of England and Wales are born to mothers themselves born in China, in India, in Pakistan, in Iraq, Iran, Africa. We're not talking about parts of Cardiff here. We're not talking about parts of Bradford or parts of Birmingham. We're talking one child in four born across the whole of England and Wales. There's been so much immigration into Britain that now we native Britons are a minority in our own capital city, London. We have been utterly betrayed by the politicians. The politicians have lied to us for the last 50 years, blatantly, with barefaced lies we've had from them for the last 50 years. When immigration was first starting in the 1950s, when Britain was essentially a 100% white country, which I happen to remember because I was born in 1943, when Britain was essentially an all-white country in the 1950s, people did not want immigration. When the first West Indians and the first Asians started coming into Britain in the 1950s, British people did not want coloured immigration into this country. In the 1950s, British people knew all about the race problems of the United States of America. They knew all about the Jim Crow laws and the colour bar laws. The British people knew all about the race problems in apartheid South Africa. In the early 1950s, British people knew all about the massacres that had taken place, the racial, religious, secular, tribal mass killings when the British left India and India when the British left the Indian subcontinent, and India and Pakistan were given their independence. 1 million were slaughtered as Muslims killed Hindus, and Hindus killed Muslims in a vast and terrible slaughter. That took place in 1948. People in the 1950s knew all about that. And then in the 1950s, people did not want these race problems imported into Britain. The British people did not want mass immigration, and they didn't want a multicultural society. So the question is, we're talking 50 years ago, when I was growing up as a child in West London, and I started seeing these, I will call them, with all respect to them, they had no right to be in our country, exotics from the tropics. I was living in West London, a little working class part of West London, My father worked for the transport company. We couldn't understand what these obvious aliens were doing in our country. So, how did the politicians deal with this situation? They told barefaced, blatant lies. In 1959, there was a major general election, a turning point in British social history. In 1959, the problems of the multiracial society were just starting to become evident. In 1959, there were the race riots in Notting Hill in West London were taking place, and the Tories wanted to win the general election of 1959. So the Tory leader Harold Macmillan, went to the nation and said, "We understand the concerns of the British people and vote Conservative in this general election of 1959 and we will stop immigration." And people thought, oh, well, that's, people were so naive. They thought, well, that's the end of that. Immigration is stopped. That's how it was.
All lies.
In 1959, I was 16 years of age. I was old enough to take an interest in politics, and I had to discuss it with my parents. That was 59. In the last 50 years, every general election that the Tories have won, they have won by claiming and stating and promising, we are going to stop immigration or control immigration or limit immigration. The Tories are so cynical, they call it playing the race card. The general election of 2010, David Cameron won that general election by promising to reduce immigration down to a few tens of thousands a year. That was 2010 when he got himself elected Prime Minister of Great Britain. In the last year of Cameron's premiership, last year, a record net 300,000 more foreigners moved into Great Britain. The Tories lie at every general election. And the Labour Party lies at every general election. The Labour Party lies by omission, because the Labour Party does not tell the electorate, does not tell their supporters, does not tell the voters, that the Labour Party intends bringing millions of more foreigners into our nation, because the Labour Party wants to change the demographics of Great Britain, as they've got the audacity to say. They've got the audacity to say we want to change the demographics of Great Britain. So, friends, ladies and gentlemen, where does that leave us, British nationalists? Where does that leave us, who have been campaigning now for 50 years, ever since that very, very brave man, that hero, Enoch Powell, warned this nation and said, we must be mad, literally mad, to be letting all these aliens into our country? The nation is piling up its own funeral pyre. I tell you, Enoch Powell was nominally a Conservative. He had been a Conservative cabinet minister. He was absolutely patriotic man. And that man, Enoch Powell, had a following right across the British working class in this country, irrespective of party label. I'll just tell you, off on a bit of a tangent here. As it happens, I come from a very humble but decent British working class. I told you my father worked for the London Transport. And my father was a Labour man because he just saw that as his interest. But when Powell spoke, my father said to me, a Labour man, right? If Powell is not thrown out the Tory party, because my father was no fool, if Powell's not thrown out the Tory party, I, your father, will vote Conservative for the first time in my life. And there were millions. Powell spoke to this nation. He spoke for millions. When he warned this nation, he really moved the heartstrings of my father and millions of others. And the Tories, in their wickedness, to quote Ted Heath, where Ted Heath said, I turn a face of stone against racism. What is racism but love of our race, yes? Yeah. Love of our patriotic British race. What else is it? What else is it? And that hard-faced Tory, Ted Heath, threw Enoch Powell into the wilderness, where he remained in millions of hearts, I might say, remained in millions of hearts. So, where does it all leave us? And where does it leave
Someone told me yesterday that it was 33 degrees yesterday, and I felt like saying to this person, we're not talking about Masons, are we? But I didn't want to push my luck. I was at BBC Head Broadcasting House, actually, giving an interview. They wanted to know about the National Front, so I always believe in obliging people. So I went along to give the BBC a talk about the National Front, of which I've been a member many years. However, when this comment about the weather, I didn't think I'd push my luck too far and talk about Masons, which is a delicate subject. I might say, by the way, the Masons have never invited me to be a member of their... Oh, well, there you are, house head, and how we'll all go crying out. We'll go crying to the polling stations, as somebody once said. So, where does it leave us, the British people, who live and work in or near these crime-wrecked, permanent riot zones that used to be our cities? Well, I have come here today, and I'm sure you've all come here today, to celebrate the great Brexit victory. A great victory where the British people have scored a victory in spite of all the threats and lies made to them from the professional liars of the party politicians. They have scored a great victory in spite of all the millions of foreigners who have been given a vote in this country. We have scored a political and psychological victory over our tormentors at Westminster, yes? And the initiative, ladies and gentlemen, fellow nationalists, fellow patriots, after this Brexit vote, the initiative is now with us. A good friend of mine, who is a London barrister and happens to have a Welsh surname, said the other day, and this man, this London barrister, is a very, very good supporter of the movement, I can tell you, has helped a number of us. This London barrister the other day said that the establishment has lost political control of the situation in this country, that the establishment is demoralised and divided, and doesn't know how to deal with the situation.
We do, though.
We do. We absolutely do. We absolutely do know how to deal with this situation. What the establishment doesn't know how to deal with, there are 17 million angry Britons out there who've just voted against them. That's what they don't want to deal with. I would like to say here, a final word, because when I was coming up here, Jez says to me, look, Richard, you've got to cut this down today. We've only got, is that right? Shorter speeches. Well, you did say that, didn't you? Don't deny you said it to me. Don't deny. Like, I've got witnesses here. Anyway, I will let other speakers speak. What I'd like to say, a final word about the National Front. I joined the National Front 40 years ago. I was amazingly, totally, totally influenced by Enoch Powell. I was a student at the time. I was at Southampton University studying engineering at the time. And I was absolutely impressed and influenced by Enoch Powell. I might say that I really enjoyed studying engineering. I enjoyed my time as a student, as an undergraduate. It's probably the most satisfactory time of my life. Because although politics is very satisfying, the fact of politics is, and I've spent 40 years in it, it just goes on and on and on. As John Tyndall once said to me, there's always more problems, Richard. There's always more problems. Well, that's just how it is. Anyway, I really enjoyed my time at Southampton University, and I knew that politics had a fatal fascination for me, and I tried to keep out of politics because I wanted to study my engineering, which I really held me. But I couldn't help noticing that Enoch Powell was there on the horizon making his speeches, and Enoch Powell was due to speak at Southampton University. And I thought, well, this is interesting. And before Powell turned up at the university, about a month before, The Tory Student Association had invited another so-called right-winger, a guy I think called Patrick Wall, who was a Tory MP, and Patrick Wall was a harmless sort of fellow. He wasn't in the league of Enoch Powell, I can tell you. And he turned up, Patrick Wall, and the left-wing students absolutely dominated the meeting. They shouted and shouted and shouted and shouted. And the result was Patrick Wall's meeting never took place. And I was sitting in the audience, I thought, blimey, how weak. And then Powell was due to speak the following month. And the leftists completely painted the university with slogans, smash Powell, smash Powell. And I thought, bloody hell, excuse my friend, what sort of world am I living in? I had gone to university to study engineering, which I enjoyed. I had no idea. I wasn't in nationalism at the time. That's what this, I'm telling you how I got into nationalism. I was amazed at the political violence that was tolerated in the university. They had their slogans everywhere. And the young conservatives who had invited Enoch Powell were pressurised by the university authorities to cancel the invitation. Now this was a man, Enoch Powell, who had moved the British working class, who had moved the British middle classes, who was supported, 90% of the British people supported Enoch Powell, recognised the man was speaking from the heart and speaking the truth, and yet the universities allowed his meeting. It never took place. And I was appalled at the weakness of the Tories, and bang, 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 then a little bit later, I joined the National Front. And I've been in the National Front, nationalism, as you know, is National Front, British National Party, National Front. They're all the same party. They're all the same party. All the same people, innit? Always doing the same thing, keeping the flag flying. But I will say to you, in case you don't know, and you may not know, that there were some amazing men and women founded the National Front in 1967, just before Powell spoke, actually. One of the founders was a lieutenant commander of the Royal Navy. Another founder was a retired admiral of the Royal Navy. There was also an air commodore of the RAF, and a number of Oxford scholars and academics founded the National Front 50 years ago. And 50 years ago, the National Front was given permission to lay a wreath at the cenotaph in central London on Remembrance Day, which of course is a tremendous honour, to be part of a political, a part of an organisation, which is a very political organisation, of course, to be allowed to lay a wreath at the cenotaph. And so, every Remembrance Sunday, we line up just across the road from Victoria Station, and with the drums beating and the flags flying, we march and parade through the historic centre of this country. We march past Westminster Abbey, where for the last 1,000 years the coronations of the kings and queens of this land have been celebrated. We march past the Houses of Parliament, which is the political centre of Great Britain. We also march past the political headquarters of the politicians who've been lying to us and betraying us for the last 50 years, and they can all lean out the windows and gawp at us as we march past their headquarters. And finally, I would like to say a thank you to all those who supported our National Front Remembrance Day parade on Remembrance Day in the centre of London there, and all those who are listening, and those who may watch this film, I invite you to join us in November as we, the future of Britain, parade through the centre of the capital of our country. Long live the British people. Long live the British people. Thank you very much.
Right. Our third speaker today is a young man from Swansea, South Wales, Mr. Alex Davis, please.
Hello everyone.
Hello.
How are we today?
Fantastic.
Brilliant. Okay, so today I would like to speak about one of those things that ever since I became involved in nationalism, it's something I've heard ad nauseum, time and time again, persistent calls for this shibboleth of Unity. Nationalist unity. If we could all just get together in one organisation or for one demonstration or in one room, we will have that victory that we've been searching for so many years. And when we talk about unity, let's just analyse the concept and the use of the term unity, the sort of context that we use it in when we talk about it in nationalist circles. So the first sort of context that we hear it in is things like unity demonstrations, a sort of tactical unity where we get together for a short amount of time and we pool our strength together, we pool our resources to show our strength as a movement. The Dover demonstrations could be an example of this, of where a dozen, 15, however many different splinter nationalist groups there are, all get together and send all their membership down to Dover or to Liverpool or to all the numerous towns where nationalists have demonstrated over the past several years. And what's the problem with this? People would say, brilliant, we're all getting together, we're all going out on the streets, we're going to smash the Reds. We're going to show our strength and show the people that we mean business. Fantastic. How can we disagree with that? Well, and some would say, we don't compromise our agency. We don't compromise our independence as organisations. Oh, brilliant. Isn't that great? And, you know, we can bring our flags along. We can have our own speakers. We can have 12 speakers on a demonstration for all the different groups. They're all represented. How wonderful. But there's only one problem with this. And I remember the last demonstration that I attended in the northeast of England, and there was a group that I was affiliated with at the time, which is now banned, and we gathered up, we marshalled our guys, and we were all there in smart lines. And we had our flags out, and we were dressed black from head to toe in a fairly uniform sort of fashion. I should add one caveat here, it was not a uniform, it was merely a uniform appearance. But then we looked at our group, and then we looked at other groups. And what did we see? We saw cheap JD Sports flags with England on them, with writing on them. We saw men who were in their 50s and 60s who really should know better, who looked as though they'd been in the pub all day. They'd been getting the drinks down them, and they were getting nice and rowdy. And they were singing things like, Allah is a pedo, Allah is a pedo, na 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 na. And if you canny do the bouncy, you're Islam. And things like this. And you can see the contrast in the groups. You can see the contrast with the approaches. Because one group wasn't for unity. One group was for the strong man is mightiest alone principle. One group was trying to embody an ideology of national socialism, the ideology of our national rebirth. Whereas others were trying to pull together people who had different ideologies, different worldviews. Some were more consistent than others. Some were more pro-Zionist than others. Some were harder on certain issues than others. Some wanted to send them all back. But they didn't quite understand the root of our problem. The internal degeneracy of the white race. And hence we had these two contrasting groups. One of young, disciplined men, organised by themselves, without any need from external any need of external help, and the other comprised of men who weren't so young, but who didn't seem to know how to organise a piss up in a brewery. Then there's the other form of unity that we hear talked about so much. That's organisational unity. That's the call of everyone. Just get together in our group. Just join our national alliance. And we'll have all the nationalists in this country together. In one big organisation, can you imagine that? No more of this disjointed, fragmented nationalist movement. No more of these groups holding, well, not even being able to hold conferences because their call-out has been so small. Wouldn't that be marvellous? Wouldn't that be marvellous to be back in the glory days of the National Front, which fragmented how many times? Can some of the older hands here tell me how many times the National Front fragmented? How many splinters have there been at the National Front?
Seven.
That's quite a lot. And I'm pretty sure within the first sort of 2-3 years, they tried getting rid of A.K. Chesterton, didn't they? And that sort of triggered a little bit of fallout.
1969, with...
So formed in 67,
yeah.
And by 69 they were already trying to off the guy in charge.
Andrew Fontaine and A.K. Chesterton fell out.
Oh, wow. That doesn't set a good precedent, does it? And maybe people should have learnt that lesson, you know, should have learnt a lesson very early on there. But here we are, something like... decades later. But people make this argument all the time. How many times have we heard for these calls of unity? Whether it's a call for a unity organisation, a national front, a nationalist alliance, or whether it's a unity demonstration, march for Britain, march for Brexit. No matter how many times you've heard these calls, every single time this strategy has been tried, it has failed. And we all know who the man was who said, the definition of insanity is to do the same thing again over and over, even though it fails. And I would say that unity is one of these things that we've got to get rid of completely. Stop thinking of our goal as being to unite the movement, because we're not a movement. Think of all the infighting there is. Think of all the backbiting there is. I'm not in a movement. I'm an independent person, unaffiliated with anyone. I'm certainly not part of a nationalist movement, because for all I can see, the nationalist movement is like a den of vipers. And if anything that recent events have taught me is that this viper... these vipers, as soon as your back is turned, or as soon as you're at a weak point, they will bite you. And I am not going to allow myself to be put in a position of weakness, where I can be bitten by a viper. And so, this call for nationalist unity, fundamentally though, the problem is that it repudiates the idea of standards. And if this nationalist movement... or if a nationalist movement is going to come about that is going to have a realistic chance of winning this country back for the white people, it is not going to come from lowering our standards, from saying that the people who are going to represent our movement will be the lowest of the low, will be the people who have tattoos, who drink too much, who do drugs, who do these things that no honest or decent person will associate with. People who tolerate low-level criminality within their ranks. People who tolerate dishonesty, inconsistency, hypocrisy. And whenever you see these calls to unity, the first thing that happens is there is compromise. Now let's put aside ideology for a while, because I know that there'll be people who disagree with me on ideology and think that the way that we should sell ourselves is different. Fair enough. But one thing that we must understand, whether it is you want to form a political party that is democratic and appeals to moderate people, conservative people, or whether it is you want to form an avant-garde, vanguardist type organisation that appeals to a revolutionary minority, the one thing you are going to need is standards. You can't have a revolution if your revolutionaries are in the pub, if your human material is worthless, is not physically fit, is not intellectually sharp, is not dedicated, and you cannot form a political party. If you don't have thinkers who can formulate policy, draft documents, who can fill in the forms and deal with the bureaucracy. Because we all know what will happen if you have a modicum of success. They will come after you. They will come after you through the Electoral Commission. They will come after you through the courts if your membership criteria doesn't quite fit the dogma of modern-day Britain, the multiracial dogma. Standards are important. Standards are necessary. And if we do not have these standards, we will not go anywhere. And this movement has adopted this horrendous attitude of a hug box. That we'll all get together and have a massive hug. And surely as nationalists, our appeal to this ideology, what made it so appealing to us, isn't because it caved into weakness, isn't because it tickled that little spot of us that's a little bit weak, but because it exhibited all of the good things in life, of strength, of vigour, of vitality. And yet our movement does not exhibit these things. And this mentality, and this call to nationalist unity, I think exhibits this sort of mentality, this loser mentality, this mentality that we can't do it on our own. Now surely if you're an organisation, if you're in a group, and you define yourself or affiliate yourself to a group, whether that's the NF, BNP, British Democratic Party, whatever, surely you must have faith in the modus operandi of that group. Surely you must have faith in your leaders, in the way that you're operating, that you can carry yourself to victory. Surely, otherwise you're wasting your time. What's the point in standing for elections, in going to demonstrations, in organising on the ground, if you don't think that what you're doing is going to carry yourself to victory? Surely that's a waste of time. Or at least that's what it seems like to me. But no, we have a loser mentality in nationalism. And nationalist unity is one of the symptoms of this. But I tell you what, I have faith. I have faith that the modus operandi that I follow and the ideology that I follow is the ideology that can win the day. It's the modus operandi that can win the day. And so I'm sticking to that. And I'm not buying into any of this unity rubbish. And why is it that nationalists have adopted this loser mentality? Why is it that nationalism has been one of these things where you can sort of get off the bus wherever you feel uncomfortable, or whatever point that you want to stop, that you don't want to go far enough, you can say, oh, that's me, I'm done, thanks. You know, if you go and, be a little bit naughty on a demonstration, you throw a couple of bricks, throw a couple of bottles, and you think, ooh, police are going to collar me, ooh, this is getting a little bit too hot for me, I want to get off, I want to capitulate, will you say, oh, it's fine? Or if you say, oh, well, I don't want to come out leafleting on this day because it's a little bit wet, or it's a little bit, the missus, she's giving me a hard time because I've been spending too much time with my, doing nationalist things, or, I've got a birthday, me and my mates are going out for a piss, so I can't miss that, can I? It's my 30th. Oh, I know we've got some canvassing to do, but I can't miss that. I know the election's coming up. I know it's really important, but, I've got some extra shifts to do because, I've got a mortgage to pay. And this is an unserious kind of attitude. This isn't a revolutionary attitude. And I, for one, believe that revolution is important. Or at least the whole revolutionary mindset is important. The idea that what we're doing is trying to irrevocably change our society, to turn it around. And if we don't have that mentality to begin with, then we are not going to win. Why is it that we've adopted this? I think it's because, fundamentally, when nationalists prophesize about the future, and they say in 60, 70, 80 years' time, Britain will be a non-white country, I think a lot of nationalists approach these views in an academic kind of way. They don't see them as happening in their lifetime. So, if what I'm doing is not really gonna see us all the way through to victory, well, there we are. But, I'm doing something, and that's fine, isn't it? And that's what most nationalists do. I've heard it a million times. They console themselves and say, well, at least I'm doing something. You can't have a go at me, I'm at least doing something, But that's a terrible attitude to have. Surely, on just the most minor examination of that, you can see that that isn't right. That isn't the right attitude to have. But that is why I'm very confident in the future. Because we are nearing that point of no return. That point where we will not have a second chance. In 30 years' time, when we become a non-white country, I'm still going to be here. People younger than me are still going to be here. And my kids are definitely going to be here. But a lot of nationalists won't be here. Or a lot of nationalists will be so old that the dementia will be setting in. They won't quite be senile. So they won't have to worry. And I think that's why there has been this lack of seriousness in our attitude. But as young nationalists, we can't afford to be complacent. Because in the area where I live, if you take away all the white students, we're already a minority. The place where I live in Swansea, the Muslims have just taken over a new mosque. Although it's not really a mosque. It used to be a Presbyterian church. They are growing in number. They're growing in confidence. And before too long, there won't be any second chances. It will be too late. And everything that we do at that after that point will come to naught because we will die as a race. And I'm not willing to let that happen. And so I say, the young nationalists in this country need to get serious. There aren't that many of us, sure. But that just makes it more challenging. And everyone knows that the best thing about a challenge is how hard it is and overcoming the difficulty of a challenge. And that is what the young nationalists in this country must do. As we all know, we've just had the first prescription of a nationalist organisation since the outbreak of the Second World War. That is unprecedented. That is an unprecedented level of oppression by the British state. Yet the young nationalists in this country are still here. We are unperturbed. And we will move forward, regardless of the cost. Because we know that unless we continue with what we're doing, unless we continue to organise ourselves politically, then we are not going to win. And the situation will get worse, and we will become a minority in our own country. I think of it like this. Everything that we've worked for in this country, everything we've built, has not come easy. We've not been given to it on a plate. The history teachers when I was at school might have said that we built an empire and we built our wealth on the back of African slavery. But we know that's not the case. We know that everything in this country that is worthwhile has been built on the exploitation of white working people. And everything that we have, our welfare state, our NHS, our benefits system, the fact that we can even form trade unions, didn't come to us because the ruling classes gave it to us. Because they were nice people. Because they thought, there we are, let's give the workers, let's give the scum, let's give the proles a little bit of crumbs from the table. They didn't do that. They did it because we struggled for it. Because our ancestors struggled for it. Before the red flag of revolution was raised anywhere in Europe, before the Paris Commune, before the revolutions of 1848, the red flag of revolution was raised in Merthyr Tydfil, of all places, in 1831, where ordinary working people faced down the rifles of the state, the mercenaries of the ruling classes. And they rose up, and still today, they are remembered as great working class revolutionaries. And remember that we didn't get trade unions and those sorts of things without people being willing to be transported all the way to Australia just for trade unions, just for the right to organise as workers. We've had to struggle for that. And my point is that every single concession that working people, that ordinary people in this country here today enjoy, has been brought about through political organisation. And we're not going to get anywhere without political organisation. And whatever political, however which way you want to organise politically, it doesn't matter. Whether it's electorally, whether it's community-based, whether it's a counterculture, whether it's on the street, it doesn't matter. Whatever suits you, whatever you do that's productive, that's the important word, not as a waste of time, but actually gets results. Whatever you can do, do it. And if we don't organise politically, we're in deep water. And we need to understand this. And now, if you look at the situation that we're in, the race war that is being engaged on us by the elite, on our white race, is intensifying. There used to be a time when we knew the victims of murders by alien criminals. We used to know their names. Charlene Downs, Gavin Hopley, Chris Donald. How long ago was it that Gavin Hopley was murdered? Can anyone remember how long ago that was? How long ago it was that this war was started against us? It's a long time ago. But now, we don't know the names of the victims, the individual victims. We call them the 1400 in Rotherham, the 80 in Oxford, the 56 in Telford. They're now numbers. It's become not an isolated case of one or two here and there. It's now systematic. It's almost industrial scale warfare against our white race. And unless we get serious about this, guys, unless we get serious about it and learn that we've got to struggle, even if it means sacrificing ourselves and our comfort, even if it means not being able to go on that nice little holiday at the end of the year, even if it means having to take a little bit of flack from your mates and from your missus because you didn't take her out to a nice restaurant on the anniversary, even if it means that, we still got to do it. And if it means we have to sacrifice even more than that, then so be it. Because we have to understand that if we're going to be serious about this, nothing is more important than our victory and the survival of our people on these islands. And so I'm going to say, to finish off, if we don't start thinking seriously and acting seriously, then we need to get out of this game. Because times are going to be tough. The ruling class are intensifying their oppression of us. The opposition are getting organised. The anti-fascists are getting organised. And they've been organised for a long time. If you don't think the political organisation works, then go to somewhere like Bristol, or Cardiff, or Newport, where anarchists on the ground have bases of support, have entrenched themselves in communities and hold real power. And I say to you, we have got to aim for real power. However we get it, that's got to be the aim. No half tracks, no compromises, victory or nothing. Thank you.
Edgeway.